This podcast may contain explicit language. Welcome to the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast, the show that uses a unique rating style to redefine what the greatest movies are. I'm Tom Duncan.
And I'm Dana Duncan.
Tonight, for our 206th episode, we revisit one of the often cited greatest movies of all time with The Godfather from 1972. Written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola with Mario Puzo, music by Nino Rota, starring Marlon Brando as Vito Corleone, Al Pacino as Michael, James Caan as Sonny, Richard Castellano as Clemenza, Robert Duvall as Tom Hagen, Sterling Hayden as Captain McCluskey, John Marley as Jack Waltz, Richard Conti as Barzini, Al Letteri as Salazzo, Diane Keaton as Kay Adams, Abe Vigoda as Tessio, Talia Shire as Connie, Gianni Russo as Carlo, John Cazale as Fredo, and Al Martino as Johnny Fontaine. Recognition for this movie? The Godfather was originally released on March 14th, 1972. The Godfather was a blockbuster, breaking many box office records to become the highest-grossing film of 1972. After 18 weeks at number one in the United States, it was the second film to gross $100 million in North America behind The Sound of Music from 1965. It remained at number one in the U.S. for another 5 weeks to bring its total to 23 consecutive weeks at number one before being unseated by Butterflies Are Free for 1 week before becoming number one for another 3 weeks. Profits were so high for The Godfather that earnings for Gulf and Western Industries, which owned Paramount, jumped from 77 cents per share to $3.30 a share for the year, according to the Los Angeles Times. It was nominated for Best Director for Francis Ford Coppola, Best Supporting Actor for James Caan, Al Pacino, and Robert Duvall, Costume Design, Film Editing, Sound, and Dramatic Score, which was subsequently revoked. It won the 1972 Best Picture Award, Best Actor for Brando, who refused the award, famously, and Adapted Screenplay for Puzo and Coppola. In 1998, it made AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies at number 3. In 2001, it made AFI's 100 Years, 100 Thrills at number 11. In 2005, for AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movie Quotes, I'm Going to Make Him an Offer He Can't Refuse came in at number 2. For 2006, AFI's 100 Years of Film Scores, this came in at number 5. For AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies, 10th Anniversary Edition, it came in at number 2. In 2008, AFI's 10 Top 10, this came in as the number 1 gangster film. In 1990, it was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry. In 1992, The Godfather ranked 6th in Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time Director's Poll. In 1998, Time Out conducted a poll, and The Godfather was voted the best film of all time. In 1998, The Village Voice ranked The Godfather at number 12 in its top 250 best films of the century list based on a poll of critics. In 1999, Entertainment Weekly named it the greatest film ever made. In 2002, Sight and Sound polled film directors again, and they voted the film and its sequel as the second best film ever. The critics poll separately voted it fourth. In 2002, The Godfather was ranked the second best film of all time by Film 4 after The Empire Strikes Back. In 2002, the film, along with Godfather Part 2, was voted at number 39 on the list of the top 100 essential films of all time by the National Society of Film Critics. In 2005, it was named one of the 100 greatest films of the last 80 years by Time Magazine. The films, however, were not ranked. In 2006, the Writers Guild of America voted it as the number 2 screenplay of all time in its list of the 101 greatest screenplays after Casablanca. In 2008, it was voted in at number 1 on Empire Magazine's list of the 500 greatest movies of all time. In 2008, it was voted number 50 on the list of the 100 greatest films by the prominent French magazine Cahiers du Cinéma. In 2009, The Godfather was ranked number 1 on Japanese film magazine Kinema Junpo's Top 10 Non-Japanese Films of All-Time list. In 2010, The Guardian ranked the film 15th in its list of the 25 greatest arthouse films. In 2012, the Motion Picture Editors Guild listed The Godfather as the 6th best edited film of all time on a survey of its membership. In 2012, the film ranked at number 7 on Sight and Sound Director's Top 10 poll. In 2014, The Godfather was voted the greatest film in a Hollywood Reporter poll of 2,120 industry members, including every studio, agency, publicity firm, and production house in Hollywood. In 2015, it was second on BBC's 100 Greatest American Films, voted by film critics from around the world. The Godfather currently holds a 97% among critics on Rotten Tomatoes. I want to know who the 3% are. A 100 score on Metacritic, and a 4.6 out of 5 on Letterboxd. So as we start each week, Dad, what is your relationship to this movie?
I believe this is the third or fourth time I've watched the entire film through. I've seen bits and pieces of it through the years, but this, I will say, is the first time that the movie really clicked and made complete understanding, and I was able to follow along and understand exactly all the nuances and what was going on completely. I don't know.
What would you say kind of made the difference for you this time?
I don't know. It's just, I never really, I don't know if it was the nature of the story. I tried to think of a reason why, somewhat, I guess to some extent, given my background in criminal defense years ago, I've just never been a big person on crime drama because, I don't know, I've been in it, so I don't find it entertaining. Kind of like I don't find law shows or legal shows entertaining. So maybe it's just I've had enough space and distance between it that I was willing to just kind of let the movie happen to me instead of trying to think about it.
So you surrendered to its glory?
If you want to phrase it that way, feel free.
I mean, as many of you out in the audience know, this has been a film that I have seen many, many, many times. In fact, I remember watching parts 1 and part 2 frequently on my iPod Touch back in 2007 when I first started working for your office and would put this on and sit it next to me while I was closing files. So I have seen both parts many, many times. I think I've seen part 1 probably about 20% more often than I've seen part 2. Part 2 gets so dark and twisted that it's harder to digest. I think it's a lot less of a casual view than the first part, which is much more of the rise, and the second part is the downfall, that it's a little bit harder for me to root for Michael when you see him clearly spiraling out of control. But we've already covered both parts. If you want to see either of our original episodes on this, I think the first episode is number 100, so that's going back to early season 3, and we originally covered this episode with Mr. Rob Conlon, a 5-time guest on the show and has his hat as a result of it. We also covered part 2 at number 125, I believe also in season 3, and that was with multiple-time guest Braden Ganter, who is a I don't know, what would we call him, a senior law clerk in our office?
Well, he is a lawyer, he just isn't licensed.
As we get into this evening, what do you think the film is about? Now that it's clicked for you, now that we've kind of passed some of the barriers, let's get into kind of the nitty-gritty. What is the movie actually about?
Every time I've watched this and you've been there, you've been screaming, "It's King Lear, it's King Lear." What the hell else am I supposed to say? It's King Lear. It's King Lear.
Well, I mean, it is. But we have many different tellings of King Lear. I mean, this is just a really good version of it.
Sure.
For those of you not familiar, and I don't want to be mansplaining, especially while we're discussing The Godfather, but King Lear is a reference to the Shakespearean play of the same name, and where the king has to pass on the throne to one of his children. Most, I believe it's his daughters, because I've never actually read or seen the play. I understand the basic tenets. I think I've read the Wikipedia plot summary of it a couple of times, just because I've seen more things that pretend to be modern King Lear than actually King Lear itself. Regardless, much like recent TV shows, what was it? Empire was the one on Fox for a while, and then eventually Succession, that was a very popular show. The king has to pass on the throne to one of his children, his daughters more specifically, and finding it very difficult to figure out which one of his children to pass it on to, because he doesn't have a specific heir that is the right choice, per se. And so much like that, we come to this situation where Vito Corleone has come near the end of his life, and he's realizing all the things he's built, he must eventually pass it on. And to which of his children does he bless by passing them his empire?
Or curse.
Well, there is that. Especially because I think, much in the way that I believe The Sopranos is discussed, there is an element where you see the rise and fall of certain immigrant communities having to do with the rise and fall of the American century. And I know that's been one interpretation often projected onto this film as well, especially when you tie it in with part two. So any other real themes stick out to you per se?
Not really. I mean, it's the story of an immigrant family and they all, how they go about assimilating. And in this particular case, it's through organized crime.
Well, a few things that really stand out to me just over the totality of the amount of times that I've watched this, and it's probably in the 30s, I would guess. There are noted elements of family, of loyalty, of duty, of understanding your place, leadership. There are actually a lot of leadership lessons in the movie, and I think in the subsequent part two as well. So there are, I think that one of the reasons that this movie is held up as much as it is because there's a lot of universal themes even within it where we can apply these to our families. It just happens to be that this family is an American crime family and they're violently killing people to advance their own business aims instead of doing hostile takeovers.
Well, I don't know. I think the last part of the film was a pretty hostile takeover.
Fair point. So why would you think that this is the number one example of a guy's guy movie?
There is so much testosterone running through this film. I mean, the women are only there to create plot points for the men. It is so much of a guy's film that it squeezes out any real feminine aspect or point of view. The women are to be taken care of. They're to be, it is about guys. It is about what guys do. It is the responsibility of men, at least in that 19th, early 20th century mentality.
I think there's a romanticized element within the film of, I can act any way I wish. I can be ruthless. I can be vicious. I can be on top. All of my behavior is potentially excused if I win out in the end. And I'm going to look at it more from a side of, let's say, the positive connections for men, why they see themselves so much in the film, as opposed to a lot of the negatives that you were highlighting. I would say that most of the women are either subservient, you're allowed to basically shut them down for questioning anything that you do. You're in positions of absolute power. Most of the women are just simply there, and you can have just about anybody that you want. A lot of this sounds very toxic, but I think that's what appeals, for the most part, to most of the men. That, much like James Bond is appealing to most men because he drives fast cars, and he goes to exotic locations, and he's able to survive dangerous stunts without having to ruffle his suit, and he gets the girl in almost every situation, and she is a real looker. This similarly has kind of an air of that as well. I can go anywhere, do anything, shoot guns. No consequences will necessarily befall me. I'll be in danger, but it's a cool kind of danger. And because of that, it's kind of a fantasy.
I think this is a lifestyle that a lot of men would like to have. I don't necessarily buy into it or necessarily agree with it, but okay.
So do you see yourself in any of the characters?
Vito, he came from nothing, started with nothing, and built his empire from nothing. I mean, I'm not knocking my parents. They were stable. They gave me a great childhood. We didn't have a ton of money. They couldn't help me a whole lot. I got my work ethic from my mother and my intelligence from my father, and I've made a lot with it. But it's, again, me figuring stuff out because I didn't have anybody to build off of. You know, it's not like I had a foundation to work from. Nobody had even applied for college in my family, let alone went. So it was a completely new experience, and I had to do it all myself. So yes, I can see that.
It would come as no surprise to anyone that I, of course, see myself as Michael, the son who most people pass over. That's not necessarily the initial logical choice to inherit the throne, but the one that feels the obligation and the duty to do so. And the reluctant challenger who is ruthless and stronger than most people give him credit for, who's been dismissed at most turns and ends up winning in the end by just playing the long game and being the smartest. Maybe, again, that's a little bit of a fantasy for me, but oh well. So are you ready to give us some additional background on this movie? Do you have our plot summary ready for us?
I do. The Godfather, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, is a timeless cinematic masterpiece that delves deep into the intricate world of organized crime. Set in 1940s New York, the film follows the Corleone family, led by an enigmatic and ruthless Don Vito Corleone, Marlon Brando. Through a gripping narrative filled with betrayal, loyalty, and power struggles, The Godfather explores themes of family legacy, honor, and the consequences of a life immersed in crime. With iconic performances including Al Pacino as the conflicted Michael Corleone and a stellar supporting cast, the film captivates viewers with its rich storytelling, evocative cinematography, and unforgettable moments that have solidified its place in cinematic history as one of the greatest films ever made.
Thank you. Did you know? Lenny Montana, Luca Brasi, was so nervous about working with Marlon Brando that in the first take of their scene together, he flubbed some lines. Director Francis Ford Coppola liked the genuine nervousness and used it in the final cut. The scenes of Luca practicing his speech were added later. Did you know? The smack that Vito gives Johnny Fontaine was not in the script. Marlon Brando improvised the smack, and Al Martino's confused reaction was real. According to James Caan, Martino didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Did you know? James Caan improvised the part where he throws the FBI photographer's camera to the ground. The actor's frightened reaction is genuine. Caan also came up with the idea of throwing money at the man to make up for breaking his camera. As he put it, "Where I came from, you broke something, you replaced it, or repaid the owner." Did you know? Orson Welles lobbied to get the part of Don Vito Corleone, even offering to lose a good deal of weight in order to get the role. Francis Ford Coppola, a Welles fan, had to turn him down because he already had Marlon Brando in mind for the role and felt Welles wouldn't be right for it. Did you know? The scene where Sonny beats up Carlo, Connie's husband, took 4 days to shoot and featured more than 700 extras. The use of the garbage can lid was improvised by James Caan. Did you know? Al Pacino's maternal grandparents immigrated to America from Corleone, Sicily, just as Vito Corleone had done. And with that, we will take our first break and we'll be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, next week, for a small break from the regular show, we heard from you listeners when we did our top 1950s movies in Season 3, and we're back with another list episode, this time giving you our personal top picks of the best movies from the 1970s. You won't want to miss that one, so make sure you are subscribed to this feed to get that episode. All right, if you have not been with us before for one of our revisit episodes, it is a little bit different from our regular show. If you'd like the normal second section where we go through best performances, best scene, best lines, that is all in our original episode, so you can find that at the beginning of Season 3 at Episode 100. But right now, with a revisit, we individually go back through what we originally had for each category, and then we give our own picks, and then eventually, as we've now started to do since I believe the beginning of last season, we negotiate on where we think the final score should be. So it is a little bit different element than our normal show. So, with that, Legacy is up first. Our original score in episode 100 was a 10. What is your new Legacy score, Dad?
I thought about a 9.5. And it's because when we did our little poll in the office, there were a lot of people who had not seen the film. And I'm wondering if it's starting to fade as far as its notoriety and popularity. But I think in the long run, though, so many of the lines, swims with the fishes, an offer you can't refuse. You know, how many times have you seen in popular culture somebody stuff Kleenex in their cheeks and like Brando? I'll stick with our 10.
You did the exact same thing I did. I was trying to figure out, you know, as this waned a little bit, maybe I should try to be a little bit more objective. And the more I thought about it, there are just too many iconic things from this movie that are still a part of popular culture. They still sell t-shirts and branded logos of The Godfather everywhere. They play the music from the film at Cleveland Cavaliers games as like everybody just recognizes it immediately for certain things. The movie has had influence all over the place in Hollywood and beyond. It's on just about every greatest movie of all time list. It is up there for just about everybody, whether you've seen it or you haven't seen it. The influence of The Godfather is far reaching, and I would have a hard time thinking about it going less than a 10. So yeah, that's that. We got it right. All right. Impact and significance. The original score on this one was a 10. Did we get it right?
I think we did, because I can't give it anything else. I mean,
having also seen Cabaret, which I'm not a particular fan of, I don't know how it lost as many Oscars as it did to Cabaret, because I want to say that holds the record for most Oscar wins without winning Best Picture with like 10 or 11. But this was the number one grossing film of all time at the time that it came out. It was an absolutely huge movie. It re-established or it reset what it was to be a box office blockbuster. This kind of started opening things in a way that we would eventually smash records over and over and over again when we get to Jaws and Star Wars and E.T., et cetera, et cetera, where these movies are much more wide released. That was the secret of The Godfather, was because it was 3 hours and you couldn't put it in a small theater and run it three or four times. In order to make as much money as it did, it decided to do what was at that time novel and wide release the movie. So you weren't putting it in a regional area and showing it only at certain theaters. You were releasing it across the country simultaneously, so everybody could go see it. And it reset the industry. It led the way for all of these commercial blockbusters that were critical darlings. It's one of the rare examples where the critics and the populace crossed over and agreed on something, which is still very rare. For me, this is a 10 out of 10. It's going to be hard to argue it's not a 10 out of 10. I know that we've left this in somewhat rare air for films like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jaws that we've done before. And I'm sure we're going to do the same with like Star Wars when we get to it next season, but it's a 10. So I think we got it right as well.
Well, I think in part, and I haven't really checked, but my guess is it was given wide release simply because by 1974, technology had become advanced enough that you could do multiple copies of the film relatively inexpensively. Because it used to be the reason you released them regionally is because you couldn't afford to make thousands of copies of the film. You know, you had to do only a few, and then you just kind of rotated them around through the country because it was so expensive. That kind of changed by that time, which made it possible. And as a result, it became a marketing ploy, which is it became a buzz, not just in the region, but nationally. So I think in and of itself, that is a significant impact. So yes, I'll agree with the 10.
All right, so 2 for 2 so far. Let's move to novelty then. Our original score on this one was a 7.33. Did we get it right?
I stick with a. I'll go with a 7. I don't think it's all that novel, because we had tons of crime movies, gangster movies. You yourself have said this is a modern version of King Lear. I can't go any higher than a 7.
So you keep saying this every time we've discussed The Godfather, that this is not novel because we had gangster films. I'm sorry, this is not James Cagney. That's not what this is. This is the first really involved modern gangster film that births an entire genre of film almost unto itself. So I don't buy that as a potential argument. Now, if you want to give it a little bit of a knock for being based on the most popular book of the moment when it came out, and that in essence, it's based in part on a similar situation of King Lear, I'll grant you some of that. But the overall techniques with which this was made, you had some of the best people, the best production, the best technicians, all working together on something that was truly great at the early point of their careers. I put this in the same conversation on a technical basis as most people talk about Citizen Kane. Gordon Willis might be the greatest cinematographer ever, and this is like the movie that jump-started him. Coppola had really only written one script to this point. He got the reins to not only do the script, but then direct the film entirely, which supplants his career. And he makes, I would say, 4 all-time classics in the 1970s, 3 of which we've discussed to this point, and one of which I haven't even seen yet, but eventually I'm sure we'll get to in, like, what, season 8? The conversation.
Don't deadpan the script that he wrote. It was Patton.
Who was denouncing it in any way?
Well, you made it sound like he was some sort of piker coming into this. After that, he was able to pretty much dictate what he wanted.
Had still never directed a film.
Okay.
Yes, he had won the screenplay, best original screenplay for Patton, but it's not like he could have just walked into anything and been able to be given directorial status. This isn't the 1990s. And he's certainly not walking into the production of the number one book at the moment. This was the decade where Steven Spielberg on a lark got given Jaws, and where Coppola got on a lark given The Godfather. And given the background and the story that it took to get this thing made, even in the first place, between all of the issues with the Italian mob and the issues again with like Frank Sinatra and all of the background, the drama between the parent company, Case and Western, and Paramount itself, et cetera, which I still think that the series that they did, The Offer on Paramount Plus, was an absolute joy to watch for any actual fans of The Godfather. It petered out a little bit by the end of the series, but I thought for about 8 of the 10 episodes, it was a great watch, at least for me. There is a high level of execution. So with all that baked in, all right, I started now kind of splitting this category as well. If I'm going to say on originality, I'm going to give it about a 3.5 out of 5. And on an execution level, I give it a 5. So I'm at an 8.5. So those are our starting points.
Okay. So why should I go up from my 7?
Well, one, I think you're undercounting some of the technical aspects of the film, both from a writing standpoint as being one of the great scripts even by or recognized within the industry itself, adapted from one of the best-selling books of all time, and it only takes a fraction of the novel. And obviously, because there are multiple parts to it, there are other pieces within the novel that I think it expounds upon later. But being able to adapt that and then being able to make it into the number one grossing movie of all time at the time that it came out, I think is impressive. The lighting and the cinematography of it, where you're using a lot of natural light, I think that's another aspect of this. The set design, production design are on top of their game, even to the level of realism, where I saw somewhere that I guess I hadn't noticed, but they went down to the point of getting wood bumpers on all of the cars, because this is just after the war and all the chrome had been taken off of the cars and given for the war effort. So they hadn't yet been replaced. That's the level of detail at which we're operating for a movie like this. Then you talk about the acting performances individually on an execution basis. This might be one of the best all-star casts that we've ever had. So I find it a little bit difficult to discount that. Now, I think what we really should be arguing over is its originality, which is what I think most of your points have been. And I still don't buy the argument that this was just another gangster film. So why should I go lower?
For a lot of the same reasons you pointed out. All right, so you're at 8.5 and I'm at 7. All right, I will go higher on than you on this, just because I'm not going to win, so I might as well get what I can. So how about an 8?
All right, I'll accept an 8. You've come up much higher than I thought I'd be able to get you to go.
I mean, I do agree it's unique.
All right. So we'll take our second break here and we'll be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, and before we get to the Stanley rubric in a minute, if you're ever curious about our Master Greatest Movies of All Time list that has every graded movie we've ever discussed on the show, there's a link in the episode description of every episode of this show, or you can go to RonnieDuncanStudios.com and find it as the top entry on the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast show page. That has the grades we've done so far for all 191 movies we've graded, and we continue to add more each week. Make sure to check that out as we go and follow along. Also, you can follow each individual episode on our website as well. That has the notes for each individual episode with all of our scores, category nominations, and the individual factoids for each episode of the show. Or just click the link in the episode description of this episode or go to RonnieDuncanStudios.com/GMOTePodcast to find that. All right, Dad, we left off at classicness. Originally, we gave this an 8.58. Did we get this right?
I would say pretty close. I would go with an 8.5. Again, it's very male dominant. And, you know, I understand that that's the world this was, but I don't know. I'm just kind of stuck at that point.
I would be higher. I think you make some decent points that this is not a particularly forgiving film for its inclusion of feminist inclusion.
Well, not just that. I mean, I understand it was for purposes of establishing Sonny's desire to protect, but I mean, beating women, he's taking a belt and smacking her around with it.
I don't necessarily think that that's the film endorsing that activity or that behavior, just showing more of a period accurate toxic relationship where there was a lot of domestic abuse. I mean, if this is a commentary on anything, it might be celebrating violence between men a little bit too much. And yeah. I might knock it a little bit more for that. But even though like the women are either subservient or they're side pieces and they're just there to kind of not really revolve much of the action. I mean, for example, I know that we probably could talk about Diane Keaton's character just kind of coming back to Michael after probably several years where she's been left in the lurch and she's pining after him while he's gone, et cetera, et cetera. But no better example exemplifies in this movie how irrelevant most of the women are. Then do we ever hear anything from Mama Corleone other than she like sings at the beginning of the movie? We kind of forget that she's there.
Yeah. And for that matter, you could very well have implied a lot. You could have had the breaking of the dishes. You could have had him taking the belt and coming after. And then, you know, it going then to her beaten and blackened without having to show the abuse itself.
He did do that the first time, but the second time, because you have to show, how much he was baited into his provocation. I do think that there is an element where you can show the level of violence, again, that is somewhat period accurate, when men could beat their wives and no one would think twice, or that they could beat their children and no one would really bat an eye. I don't know if it that period ages well, but I don't know if the movie necessarily ages poorly as a result of it. Now, the one thing that I really knock for inclusion in this movie is there's a brief nudity scene, which seems wholly unnecessary, and add in the fact, and I mentioned this on the original episode, it's involving an underage girl.
Oh, I forgot about that. How old was she?
I think she was either 16 or 17 when the movie was made.
Which may not have been underage in Italy.
Even so, it's kind of, like, I don't give it huge major points, but it at least took off a point for me. It just kind of is weird. I don't understand why it needs to be in the film. We already know that Michael got married and that he's had a loving relationship. You could have just done without the actual nudity of it and had them, I don't know, in a romantic embrace of some kind. It just seemed titillating for the sake of being titillating.
Yeah.
There were so many other things in this film that you could have focused on. And I see that inclusion as another example of, okay, well, the women are only here to look pretty and to serve the men. So
yeah,
I came down at a 9. You have an 8.5. I don't think I'm going to belabor the point too much, especially when we've talked about a lot of the negatives. I'll just meet your 8.5, but
okay.
Point taken. All right. Here's where scores may really vary, because I know that when we had Rob on, this is not a particular favorite of his. Our earlier rewatchability score was an 8.25. Did we get this right?
I think so. I would give it an 8. I don't know if I was at an 8 last time around, but it's growing on me.
So I think this was one where I may have tried to manipulate the numbers a little bit and given a number
really?
That was a little bit higher so that it didn't score quite so low.
Really? A little bit disingenuous?
Eh.
Yeah, well, not that that's ever happened before. The Dark Knight.
Hey, now, I was not disingenuous at all with that film.
You were trying to engineer it.
I got on two people that loved the movie.
Yeah.
Because doing that particular movie was somewhat for me. But okay, I didn't necessarily know whether we would get it to number one. I had high hopes. But I'm not disappointed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like you haven't tried to manipulate the list before. North by Northwest, Casablanca on multiple occasions.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Saving Private Ryan, All the President's Men, all of which occupy space in our top 10.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Anyway, I'm at a 9.5. This is not a 10 for me. Like, I'm not going to sit down and this is easily one that I'm putting on and it's going to make me feel better at any point. But I have no problem watching this movie anytime it's on. I will actively put this on of my own volition. And the minute it's on, it's staying on until I'm finished with the film. For being a 3-hour film, this movie moves. It's got great pace. It doesn't really slow down too much. There are a couple of spots where, you know, you might skip a small scene here and there, especially if you've seen it 30 some times like I have. But I have absolutely no issue with wasting a Saturday afternoon watching The Godfather and just appreciating greatness over and over and over again, even if it does make me the prototype of cringiness in Barbie.
Well, I thought I went a lot by coming up to an 8 because I don't think I was there.
That's fine. I figured we just split the difference.
All right.
It's hard to argue rewatchability because it's such a subjective taste element. So it's really going to be the only way to argue that one. Like, we could have had a much bigger fight on legacy or impact and significance, and it just wasn't there to be had. So that's an 8.75 for the final score on that one. Now, for audience score, originally we had a 92% for Google and a 98% for Rotten Tomatoes, giving us a 9.5. However, I don't know who is voting down this movie at Google, but it lost 2 percentage points there. So we are now at a 9.4. Sad, people. Just sad. So to repeat the categories, we went from a 10 to a 10 on Legacy. We went from a 10 to a 10 on Impact and Significance. We went from a 7.33 to our new score of 8 on Novelty. We went from 8.58 to 8.5 on Classicness, so slightly down. We went from an 8.25 on Rewatchability to an 8.75. And for audience score, we went from a 9.5 to a 9.4. So our original total was a 53.66 and is currently number 9 on our list. Where do you think this one comes in at? Want to place a guess?
11.
You think it moves down?
Where was it?
It was at number 9.
Oh, then it'll come in at 5.
Our new score is 54.65. And that would place it on our list at number 6, between Casablanca and Saving Private Ryan.
Okay.
So it moved up a couple of spaces, but not a ton. Gonna have to keep working on you. Maybe one of these times.
Sure.
If you disagree with any of our scoring, you could write us at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com or find us on any of our socials at Gmote Podcast. On YouTube, Letterboxd, X, TikTok, or Instagram, and I think even our Facebook page. Let's move to In Memoriam. Dad, do we have anyone to remember this week?
Yes. Paula Weinstein, 78, American film producer. She produced The Perfect Storm, The Fabulous Baker Boys, Blood Diamond, and the series Grace and Frankie. She was also a political activist and a 2-time Emmy winner. Fritz Wepper, 82, German actor. Derek Cabaret, Die Brück, and For Heaven's Sake. Ron Harper, 91, American actor. Planet of the Apes, Land of the Lost, Generations, and 87th Precinct. And this is one that I have an emotional tie to because I think this guy was awesome. M. Emmett Walsh, 88, American actor, Blade Runner, Blood Simple, and Fletch. This guy had been a character actor for decades before he was in Blood Simple and kind of propelled himself into a more eminent character actor in Hollywood.
And so we remember these here fondly with a moment of silence in their honor. Thank you. Okay, before we go, we have a couple of things to clean up. So first, we did get a couple of audience questions specific to The Godfather. So number one, please rank the nominated acting performances for The Godfather. Marlon Brando, James Caan, Robert Duvall, and Al Pacino.
It's almost a perfect list in order. I would go Brando, Duvall, Caan, and Pacino.
See, I go the exact opposite, the inverted. I go Pacino 1, I go Duvall 2, Caan 3, and I go Brando 4.
Yeah, I don't. Because I don't think Pacino really, other than the fact that he had to look menacing at times, had to do a whole lot of acting.
I just entirely disagree. There is so much that he's doing with his eyes through the course of this movie that you see again in part 2, where you can see the calculation constantly going on. You see the maniacal, ruthless part of him, the rage that's behind everything, that it's just waiting to bubble up at any moment and be let out of its cage. So I think he's by far the best actor in the entire movie. But I also love Duvall and Tom Hagen. Which leads us to our second question, and I will give credit for both of these questions to our friends over at Best Picture Cast, specifically Kieran B., would you hire Tom Hagen at your law firm?
In a heartbeat, because ultimately Tom Hagen is the prototypical lawyer. It's a matter of, okay, so he's representing the family in this particular case. Everything he says and does is how a lawyer would behave or for a normal client or should, right down to being guarded about, you know, I can't take this letter, okay, because then I would be, a court of law would be assuming that I know where Michael is. I mean, that line in and of itself, I went like, why, there's somebody who has some accurate thoughts. That was a line in this that I thought, yeah, this is a situation where somebody actually thought about what the law was and applied it.
Absolutely, we would hire him. One, he is trustworthy and loyal to a fault. Two, he's actually a very good advisor. He seems to have a very level head. He knows kind of how to play the game. He doesn't take things too personally. He's a great number two. And three, he's very good on the law. So of course, yes, we would hire him.
Yes. And in fact, if there's anybody out there who thinks they're Tom Hagen and has a law degree, please email the show with a copy of your resume. We are hiring.
I can just feel the weird emails coming in. At least you caveated it with, if you have a law degree.
Wouldn't that be ironic if somebody actually listens and sends it and we end up hiring them, him or her?
Only a little bit, given that there are several members of our staff now who are regular listeners of the show. So, All right. And that leads us into our regular segment now of Ask Dana Anything.
So, I can hardly wait.
I got 12 new questions.
Wow.
From our friends, you know, either at the Best Picture Cast or the Revisionist Almanac. We have some that are in varying degrees of obnoxiousness. I, in fact, asked them, since they were the ones providing it, that I felt you would find it funnier the more obnoxious they are.
Okay.
How obnoxious do you want it to go? I have from like everything down to the very low levels where you'll like scoff at the question to the height of obnoxiousness.
Okay, so work from both ends towards the middle. So give me first a low level one.
Okay, so as a Wisconsinite, cheese or beer?
Ooh, do I have to choose?
Yes. I think the implication of the question is that one has to go away forever.
Damn.
Yeah, this is a hard
one. I don't have a replacement for cheese. I can drink bourbon for the rest of my life instead of beer, so I'll take cheese.
I think that's the right answer. I put cheese in and on too many things to let that go away. And there really isn't a great substitute for trying to make it in any regard. Whereas I like beer, but I don't necessarily need to have beer for the rest of my life. There are plenty of other drinks out in the world. I enjoy my beer, but I'd be okay if I never had another one.
Yeah. Pizza, lasagna, Parmesan cheese on spaghetti.
Yeah. Not the powdered shit either. Like actual shredded Parmesan. But anyway. All right.
Grated. Not shredded.
So this is probably our most obnoxious question. Okay. And this comes from the mind of Andrew Corns himself.
Okay.
If Dana were the type of father to rank his children Iron Claw style, where would Tom be on that list? Just to give you a little bit of an out, that list is ever changing if it's Iron Claw style.
Yeah, I know. I'd have to say that you're number one right now simply because you're most ruthless. Your sisters.
What?
Yes.
Because of my ruthlessness?
Yes, because your sisters would just cave. That whatever. We just accept that you're just an asshole, Tom. There, fine.
Well, that's
there
true.
You are. There you are. Fine. You can be the asshole. I can just hear them and they'll feed off each other and you'll like kind of, you know, like do the Rocky at the top of the art center you know, shuffle there with the fists raised high. Yeah. So yes, that's where I'm going with that one.
Okay. I wasn't expecting to necessarily be one. I thought you'd try and figure out a way of like dodging the question.
No, because I can tell you right now, if I called your sisters and told them, this is the question, this is my answer, they would all go, yeah, okay, got it. Yep, I understand. I agree. You were right.
Well, you understand that Iron Claw rankings is like favorite to their father as like the top of his love at any one point.
Okay, I understand that that's the top of their love. It's not about love. It's about who's winning and who's the most capable of achieving whatever bullshit he heaps on them at that moment in time. That's the Iron Claw style. It's not about the love, because fathers should not be judging his love on how well he is able to manipulate his children into following the direction he wants. That's not love. That's narcissism. I have said ultimately, and I will say this on the show, of all the things I have done in my life, lawyer, politician, church leader, the one that I'm the most proud of is if I'm told that I was a good father.
I think most people would accept that as being their number one charge in life, or at least the people that it's important to, I would assume, have been good, not necessarily great, but good parents. I'm not even sure necessarily how you would become a great parent. That's neither here nor there. To be fair, and I think my sisters would agree with you only in the standpoint that they could, again, call me asshole, which to a degree in this family has kind of become my pet name.
That's the one they can say in public.
Neither of my sisters seems overly inclined to call me like fucker or motherfucker or, you know.
Oh, something really? I can name one of them that does quite often.
Oh, well, then that's news to me. I wouldn't be bothered by it, but they've never said it in my presence. So, okay.
I'm surprised she hasn't. Mm. Depends on how mad you make her.
See, this is the thing. I'm not even sure which one it would be. I could see, well, boy, this is a toss-up for me.
Let's just put it this way. I'll tell you, if I say this, you'll know immediately, the more emotional one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The one who's prone to larger swings of outburst.
I love you so much. You're such a fucking asshole.
I can't take this anymore. Let me hide under a purple blanket in the back seat.
I don't know how often she listens to the show. But
I don't think she listens at all, thank God.
I love her. She's like an emotional pendulum.
Anyway, moving on. Final thoughts for the week.
Hey, we have the Wisconsin Film Festival coming up and the Beloit Film Festival coming up, and I am looking forward to them. At some point here, it didn't work out this year, next year, if they actually get their schedules out early enough, I'm going to take the entire week or time off and just stay and watch films all week and whatever, because I have reached that point in my life where I don't feel like I have to work constantly. I have people who work for me taking up some of the responsibilities of what I have done, and I would like to enjoy some of this. So I'm looking forward to it. There's several great films that I have on my list of things I want to watch, some comedies, some documentaries. It's a great time for me. I'm really looking forward to it. You and I will be doing the Madison or the Wisconsin Film Festival in Madison. They kind of overlap, so we wouldn't get down to Beloit that first weekend they're open. But the second weekend, your mother and you and I are committed to going, so I'm looking forward to it.
So I don't always recommend things every time on Remaining Thoughts, and most times I just kind of skip it because I don't have anything to add. But I'm in the middle of possibly the best show of the year right now. And it seems to get better with each subsequent episode. When I first started it, I thought, this is kind of slow. I'm not sure what to make of it. It's kind of building towards something, but I don't know what it is. I'm hoping this kind of gets better. To now each episode is like appointment viewing. And I will highly, highly recommend FX's Shogun, if you haven't seen it. The remake of the original TV series based on the James Clavell novel from the late 70s. It is fantastic.
It seemed like in the 1970s, they were looking for vehicles to put Richard Chamberlain in to do a mini series on network TV.
All I'll say is they're incredibly accurate with most of the history and the evolution of things during that historical time. They do a great job with the production design, the action sequences. There are only a few small instances of some CGI, but the characters and the acting performances in it are just outstanding. And if you don't mind some subtitles, because I would say 75 to 80% of the series is in Japanese, and if you have to, even though it offends most of my film bro community, you can even find an option where it's dubbed in English on Hulu. So there is that if you want to go that route. I don't watch it in that route. I allow for myself to experience it in the way it was supposed to be, but that is at least an option if it gets you to watch something that's of quality like this.
See, as long as we're talking about that, I've done both. And quite frankly, I think I get more out of a film by having it dubbed, because the voice and the inflection and how the lines are delivered is more impactful to me for the overall visual aspect than trying to watch and read at the same time.
Now, most times I am not against either version. I have watched certain things in the dubbed version before, and I don't think that there was much lost because they're all talking in the native tongue. But because this show pivots back and forth between some level of English and Japanese, and because one of the central figures is constantly translating between English, which is actually supposed to be Portuguese, but we understand it, so it's kind of in our perspective, and native Japanese, there is an element of the storyline that I think is very interesting when she doesn't directly translate what's actually being said, and she's very selective about how things are translated between the two languages and who's getting what perspective or what is actually being said. So I do think that's actually additive, and where I would say you may miss something if you are in the dubbed version comparative to the actual original intended subtitled version.
Okay. I guess to each their own. I'm just telling you kind of what my thought is on it and what I've experienced, but I would try it both ways.
But either way, it is currently available on Hulu, and I think they have now integrated Hulu completely into Disney Plus. So now you can find it on either if you're subscribed to either. But I would highly recommend that show. If it's not my number one show of the year, it must be a really good year. And I know, I mean, I'm still enjoying Tokyo Vice, which was my number two show of 2 years ago, I believe. And we still have a second season of Severance, and we have many more great things coming up. But man, this is an entertaining as all get out. With that, that'll do it for us this week. Thank you for listening. Forget it, Jake. It's the 1970s. Next week, for our small break from the regular show, we heard from you listeners when we did our top 1950s movies in season 3. And we're back with another list episode, this time giving you our personal top picks of the best movies from the 1970s. You won't want to miss that one, so make sure you are subscribed to this feed to get that episode. Please like, follow, rate, and review, or whatever on whichever platform you have so that more can join in on our fun. You can also email the show at thenewRodneyDuncanStudios.com or at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com, or find us on YouTube, X, Instagram, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle @GMotePodcast. Greatest Movie of All Time is a production of Ryan Duncan Studios. Our show is mixed, edited, and written by Thomas Duncan. Our music is thanks to Purple Planet Music. Our technical provider and distributor is Captivate FM.